Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
I'm going to continue with Canto 3, Chapter 21. Nice verse with nice long purport. Text 12. Datta Harsha, naturally jubilant. Apatat, he fell down. Murdana, with his head. Shitao, on the ground. Labdha, having achieved. Mana Rata, his desire. Gir Bihi, with prayers. And Arbya Granat, he satisfied. Priti Swabhava Atma. Priti Swabhava Atma, whose heart is by nature always full of love. Krita Anjalihi, with folded hands. Translation: when Kardama Muni actually realized the Supreme Personality of Godhead in person, he was greatly satisfied because his transcendental desire was fulfilled. He fell on the ground with his head bowed to offer obeisances unto the lotus feet of the Lord. His heart, naturally full of love of God, with folded hands, he satisfied the Lord with prayers. Purport: the realization of the personal form of the Lord is the highest perfectional stage of yoga in the sixth chapter of Bhagavad Gita, where yoga practice is described. Okay?
The light, do you...
I'm okay. Where yoga practice is described, this realization of the personal form of the Lord is called the perfection of yoga. After practicing the sitting postures and other regulative principles of the system, one finally reaches the stage of samadhi, absorption in the Supreme. In the samadhi stage, one can see the Supreme Personality of Godhead in his partial form as Paramatma, or as he is. Samadhi is described in the authoritative yoga scriptures, such as the Patanjali Shastras, to be a transcendental pleasure. The yoga system, described in the books of Patanjali, is authoritative. And the modern so-called yogis, who have manufactured their own ways, not consulting the authorities, are simply ludicrous. The Patanjali yoga system is called Ashtanga Yoga. Sometimes impersonalists pollute the Patanjali yoga system because they are monists. Patanjali describes that the soul is transcendentally pleased when he meets the super soul and sees him. If the existence of the super soul and the individual soul is admitted, then the impersonalist theory of monism is nullified. Therefore, some impersonalists and void philosophers twist the Patanjali system in their own way and pollute the whole yoga system. Paragraph. According to Patanjali, when one becomes free from all material desires, he attains his real transcendental situation And realization in that stage is called spiritual power. In material activities, a person engages in the modes of material nature. The aspirations of such people are 4 things. To be religious. 2. To be economically enriched. 3. To be able to gratify the senses. And at last, 4. To become one with the Supreme. According to the monists, when a yogi becomes one with the Supreme and loses his individual existence, he attains the highest stage called Kaivalya. But actually, the stage of realization of the personality of Godhead is Kaivalya. The oneness of understanding that the Supreme Lord is fully spiritual, and that in full spiritual realization one can understand what he is, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, is called Kaivalya. Or, in the language of Patanjali, realization of spiritual power. His proposal is that when one is freed from material desires and fixed in spiritual realization of the self and the super self, that is called Chit Shakti. Chit Shakti. In full spiritual realization, there is a perception of spiritual happiness, and that happiness is described in Bhagavad Gita as the supreme happiness, which is beyond the material senses. Trance is described to be of 2 kinds. Did you know that? 2 kinds of trance. Here they are. Sampragyata and asampragyata, or mental speculation and self-realization. In samadhi, or asampragyata, one can realize by his spiritual senses the spiritual form of the Lord. That is the ultimate goal of spiritual realization. Paragraph. One final paragraph. According to Patanjali, when one is fixed in constant realization of the supreme form of the Lord, one has attained the perfectional stage, as attained by Kardama Muni. Unless one attains this stage of perfection, beyond the perfection of the preliminaries of the yoga system, there is no ultimate realization. There are 8 perfections in the Ashtanga yoga system. One who has attained them can become lighter than the lightest and greater than the greatest, and he can achieve whatever he likes. But even achieving such material success in yoga is not the perfection or the ultimate goal. The ultimate goal is described here. Semicolon. Actually, this is a colon. Kardama Muni saw the Supreme Personality of Godhead in his eternal form. Devotional service begins with the relationship of the individual soul and the Supreme Soul, or Krishna and Krishna's devotees. And when one attains it, the relationship, there is no question of falling down. If, through the yoga system, one wants to attain the stage of seeing the Supreme Personality of Godhead face to face, but is attracted instead to attainment of some material power, then he is detoured from proceeding further. Material enjoyment, as encouraged by bogus yogis, has nothing to do with transcendental realization of spiritual happiness. Real devotees of bhakti yoga accept only the material necessities of life absolutely needed to maintain the body and soul together. They refrain completely from all exaggerated material sense gratification. They are prepared to undergo all kinds of tribulation, provided they can make progress in the realization of the personality of Godhead. So, looking for this phrase. Spiritual power. According to Patanjali, when one becomes free from all material desires, he attains his real transcendental situation. And realization of that stage is called spiritual power. There's lots of ideas out there in the spiritual marketplace. And when someone is sincerely searching, it can be bewildering. I mean, lots of people aren't searching. Reading this purport, I was thinking and appreciating how Prabhupada saw that confusion, and not only was Prabhupada giving the genuine thing, but paring away or analyzing and then dismissing other options without naming names of, you know, this version, that version. I read something recently where Prabhupada was explaining how he was advice to preachers or to, you know, to us, his students, how to deal with the question that sometimes arises when somebody asks, what do you think about so-and-so? And so here's like three parts to his advice. He said, don't immediately respond, you know, so-and-so is, you know, whatever, however bogus or however you finish. Because by doing so, just, it gives credence to the person. So don't, you know, don't respond to the person. Ask, what is their teaching? What's their message? And then you can address the message. And then, you know, show where the holes are in the message and then present the alternative. And that way, you're not, it's not an attack on the person nor giving undue credit to the person. It's just dealing with principle. So, in the spiritual marketplace, in this period of time that Prabhupada was writing, it hasn't, like, the shops haven't diminished, they've increased. How to, if you're going to be a world acharya, how to guide persons to receive the genuine thing. I heard a lecture one time when Prabhupada was, it was at 22nd Avenue, and, you know, just picture the scene with all these young Western people that you know, they were also being bombarded with so many different ideas. Then so Prabhupada was speaking about the necessity of finding a bona fide spiritual master and taking shelter of a bona fide spiritual master and being trained by a bona fide spiritual master. So right in the middle of the class, somebody blurted out, "Swamiji, how do you know who's a bona fide spiritual master?" So Prabhupada just stopped the class and addressed his question. And he explained that, first of all, it's incumbent upon you to know what a bona fide spiritual master is before you select a bona fide spiritual master. Then he gave an example. He said, supposing you go to the marketplace to buy a diamond. You don't know what a diamond is. What's going to happen? The merchants will figure it out really quickly. This person doesn't know what a diamond is. So what goes onto the counter is not a diamond, whatever it is, you know, plastic or broken glass or whatever it is. And they'll tell you, this is a diamond. So before you go to the marketplace to buy a diamond, it's your responsibility to have a basic idea of what a diamond is. So similarly, bona fide spiritual master. And then, so it's based upon authoritative scripture, not just, you know, not some other criterion of, as he would say, a long beard or, you know, he has a nice smile or, he, you know, he's charismatic or he can do mystic power or something. What's the criterion to understand the qualification? It's there in scripture, it's there in Bhagavad Gita and Bhagavatam. And how does one know? Through the authoritative literatures. So now going to the yoga practice. So Prabhupada is preparing us and his followers how to discern, you know, illusory presentations of yoga and something that's genuine. One of the references is there's authoritative scriptures that describe what the yoga system in several times is referring to Patanjali. And at least the versions of Patanjali that I'm acquainted with is largely rendered and presented by impersonalists. And so one who reads Patanjali, they're directed to something impersonal. In Chicago, there's a very nice devotee, Gokulananda from Argentina, and he's developing a huge, mostly Mexican, but otherwise, you know, all varieties of Spanish-speaking people in Chicago. So he's developing something like a sangha of the Spanish-speaking people. And one of the Spanish-speaking people is a young woman who's a teacher of yoga, and then I asked what type of yoga, and she said Ashtanga yoga. And I didn't go to the next question because I didn't want her to be offended, because I think in the course of time she'll pick it up. But I can practically guarantee, without asking the question, upon what do they meditate? Something very similar to the discussion yesterday evening. Something impersonal or void, not the personality of Godhead. And that's even if they get that far. Meaning, many people in Chicago or anywhere, Portland or anywhere, that want to sign up for a yoga class, they're not interested in perfection. They're not just interested in the goal. They're interested in something, you know, something that they can grab a hold of and like sense gratification. It'll make me healthy, trim and slim, beautiful, you know, and things like that. More feeling more peaceful, more energetic, something. Something, they feel some physical or mental or both, you know, better. The goal is far from what they're interested in. But if you, you know, keep, go a little further and scratch the surface a little bit, maybe, maybe not, but maybe the teacher knows where the train is headed. They're headed for impersonalism. There was a period of time when I was taking a panchakarma treatment in Bombay. And maybe you know this devotee, Chaitanya Vallabh, disciple of Radhanath Maharaj, lives in Bombay. He expired. But he was involved with Sridhar Maharaj in the Bhishma project way in the beginning. Anyway, I was staying in a place not far from his home, and he was taking me, you know, very kindly, because he was retired, taking me every day back and forth to the clinic. And his wife wasn't so much of a devotee, but she liked yoga. And the yogi that she was taking classes from was promoting himself as a healer. So she really wanted me to go to see the yogi. I really didn't want to go to see the yogi. But, you know, she was, you know how it is, pleased and insisting and repeating and over again. So finally I said, okay. So we went. It's on the other side of Bombay. It took like an hour and a half to get there. And then when we went there, it's this huge banyan tree off kind of, you know, where it's not developed yet. And then there's like this flat, little raised flat area where everyone was doing yoga. And so just like very quickly, he was known, his renown was people that did his yoga that had chronic health problems got relieved of their chronic health problems. So he was like a popular guy. Go do yoga instead of get surgery. And then so they brought me in. I'm a sannyasi, dressed as a sannyasi in the middle of their, like, you know, the circle of their yoga class. And then one by one, it was like an advertisement. One stood up and said, I had a heart problem and all the doctors said surgery, and I went to another one in surgery and another one in surgery, and I came here and now it's no surgery and I'm cured. And then the next one, something and something and something. So it was like, sign up. I just kind of kept quiet. And then as I was walking away from that circle, there was a little, you know, a not refined, kind of hand-made wooden chair. And on the seat of the wooden chair, leaning against the back of the chair, was a picture of the universal form. And the assistant to the main yogi, sixth and teacher, pulled me to the side. And I got the sense that he was thinking, well, you know, you're involved in spiritual things, so I'll tell you a secret. And the secret was, see the picture over there? It's just imaginary. The real goal is behind the form to enter the formless. And my blood started to boil. And, you know, over there, they're getting them involved in healing. But, you know, where's the train going? They get really hooked into the yoga system, and, you know, those that are more spiritual than the others, they get to know the real secret. Become one with the Supreme. That's where the train is going. So I didn't want to get into like a session with them about you people are nonsense. I just, you know, thank you very much. And so whether it's, you know, the Spanish population in Chicago, or the, you know, yogi in Bombay, or the generic view in the spiritual marketplace, if you ask, you'll get an impersonal understanding. And I'll say it differently. Unless there's association with a devotee, and there's some interest in spirituality, where's it going to go? It's going to go to impersonalism. Because how does bhakti begin? There's a very beautiful chapter in Madhurya Kandambani where Vishwanath Chakrabarti Thakur asks that question. How does bhakti begin? And, you know, in a classic fashion, he says, some people say this and then refutes it. Some people say that and then refutes it. Some people say something else and refutes it. Then he says, now here's another option. Bhakti begins by associating with one who is carrying bhakti. Then it's like even more detail. It's like a madhyama bhakta, because an uttama bhakta, anyway, someone, even an uttama bhakta that's taking the role of a madhyama bhakta, then they give bhakti. So we don't get a spiritual, we don't get a personal conception except through association with a bhakta. So I'll say it again. Minus the association of a devotee, someone that has a spiritual inclination is going to head towards something impersonal. And when, or void, like we were speaking last night. And when someone is holding on to an impersonal or voidistic conception, it's like taking a toy from a baby. You know, they don't want to let go. They're holding on. I'm using that example because I've seen it happen. You know, the child will start to scream, even if it's like something insignificant. Take something from their hand and they don't like it. So, how to release that attachment to something that's impersonal or void. Even when very few people are interested in something spiritual anyway. Like the verse from the first canto Bhagavatam, where the sages say to Suta Goswami, this age of Kali is very bad. That all the good qualities are practically destroyed. Praye nao payushak shabya kalavaskmin yugejana manda sumanda matayo manda bhagya. Greatly unfortunate. So if very few people are interested in something spiritual, and those that are interested in something spiritual, they don't have the capacity, and there's so many people ready to cheat them, and there's so much quarreling and arguing, and go into the spiritual marketplace and your head will spin. So it's so important, the Bhaktivedanta purports, in detail, very eloquently and very clearly and over again, presenting this is the real thing and these other options are misleading. And so here, so the standard literature he's referring to in this case, Patanjali, twice he indicates the transcendental situation is one of spiritual power. Now, practitioners of yoga, many, wish to have material powers. The Ashta Siddhis, the Eightfold Mystic Perfections, or, you know, something, like a little magic at least. But, you know, that's what they're after. That's like the fuel in their tank. That's the carrot that they're chasing after. They want some spiritual power. But Prabhupada is making it clear that, and because he says it again, that spiritual power is the position where you don't fall down, where you have actual shelter of the personality of Godhead, without which you'll fall down. Supposing you get some mystic power, where's the shelter? You know, or where's that? What's the happiness? Why would people want some mystic power? I could do something you can't do, or something like that. Prabhupada makes it very clear in his Nectar of Devotion, that each one, and he goes through it very slowly, very carefully, each one of the mystic powers are the same things that materialists, through mechanical means, are trying to attain. And to some degree they can attain, to fly in an airplane. And so you can fly without an airplane, and etc. Acquire something from a distant place. You know, in mystic powers are material. But people that see the exhibition of mystic power think, oh, that's spiritual. It's because in this age people are very poor in their understanding of truth. Just like, I mean, a little bit the same, my experience is that where there's a little exhibition of goodness, people think that person is spiritual. Like, you know, this phrase, don't be religious, be spiritual. It's a popular notion, and by that it means don't become part of anything that is authentic, like, you know, coming, descending fashion from God, and absorb yourself in that. Like, organized religion is bad because it's organized. So better just be spiritual, because that's the goal of religion anyways, is to be spiritual. So then what does be spiritual mean? Well, then, you know, they have there's when there's no standard, you can say anything, that's spiritual. And largely it's, you know, just some exhibition of the mode of goodness, some compassion, or some kindness, some like that kind of thing, being like a Boy Scout or something. I'm a little sarcastic, but it's unfortunate. That's the reality. And you know, they can do anything. Like this. Anyway, they can do anything. Violent, you know. And as long as their eating habits and their speech and things, what they do with their senses and the purpose that drives the use of their senses. Anyway, the idea of spiritual is so vague. The idea of yoga is so vague. The idea of something that I heard Prabhupada say a number of times, I really like. It's like, because he said it a number of times, I started paying attention to it, and it's something that is very helpful, I find. Prabhupada said, if you identify the goal, clearly identify the goal, then it's very easy to take steps to reach the goal. And the converse, if you don't identify the goal, it's very difficult to get there. And whatever there is, just, you know, it's vague and amorphous. And it keeps changing. You know, it's the modes of nature acting on the mind. And that's what the goal is. So the goal is, he's making it very clear. He's saying the Patanjali system is speaking of spiritual power. Spiritual power. But what's that spiritual power? It's not the mystic cities. It's those are material. It's the fixed position of shelter in the personality of Godhead, where you can't fall down. You connect with the personality of Godhead and you stay fixed. Something he repeats three times in the purport also is, without material, no longer material desire. Well, that's awesome. I mean, what is that condition? Or do you know of anybody that's free of material desire? It's a very elevated position. very elevated position. And it's possible by connection with the Supreme Pure, then the things that are impure, they drop. They fade, and then they drop. That's the spiritual power. And there isn't a substitute, because otherwise one may go to a very high position. I was expecting the Prabhupada was going to give the examples of Vishwamitra or Saurabhi Muni, who achieved, you know, great states of mystic yoga power, but by some material agitation, they fell. Because they weren't fixed. So that spiritual power, while certainly yogis are powerful, in certain ways perhaps more powerful than us, in terms of the austerities that they have the capacity to undergo, and, you know, powers that they may exhibit, and in that sense, perhaps one can say, but that's not spiritual power. Our bhakti process is to attain shelter of Krishna. And by attaining shelter of Krishna, there's power in that. We're protected from the onslaught of Maya in ways that a yogi is not protected from the onslaught of Maya. Just a little anecdotal thing. Some devotees were taking part in a visit to Udupi. This is like 10 years ago. And there were a group of devotees, very well-educated devotees, and, you know, but, you know, very absorbed in the bhakti process. And the system in Udupi is there's 9 mats, or temples, with Krishna mat in the center, and there's 8 others of the different that Madhvacharya established. So a lot of detail, but 10-12 years ago, there was a very, very elder sannyasi who was respected amongst all the sannyasis. Each of the mats has a grihastha that does the managing and a sannyasi that does the teaching, preaching. And they have schools and so many things. So the senior sannyasi was very curious about, you know, this exhibition of what they were doing and kirtan and classes and, you know, lots of enthusiasm and bright young people. So he requested, there's some things that preceded this, but he requested, I'd like to ask some questions and see, like, examine your teachings. And so they made the arrangement, and he had like 10 questions, and, you know, what is your teaching on such and such? And, you know, so the devotee spoke, our teaching is such and such, and then quoted a scriptural verse. He said he prayed a whole lot before that interview, and somehow Krishna supplied the verses that illustrated the questions. And at the end, the sannyasi, you know, he wasn't commenting, he was just asking. At the end, he said, almost the same. Almost the same, like that. So then in the course of the exchange, because we're from Madhva Sampradaya, they were asking, can you share some special prayers and songs that, you know, that are part of your practice here? And there was some of that. And then the devotees had this video, Your Ever Well Wisher. You know, so he wanted to see it. Or I guess that several of the sannyasis wanted to see it. And they viewed the video. And their conclusion was, we could never do that. What your Swamiji has done, because they were referring to the scene in Golden Gate Park and young, intoxicated people with long hair and, you know, dancing and carrying on. Said, we could never do that. We would fall down. We could never do that. He was protected by Krishna. And similarly, you know, who are we? We're like, you know, little nobodies. And we're trying to practice Krishna consciousness just by our basic practices of hearing and chanting, and so many things. And, you know, our life is becoming elevated, and if, provided we follow the process properly, we're protected. We're protected from the onslaught of Kali Yuga, provided we practice properly. In the midst where, you know, degradation is abundant, without detailing the degradation that's abundant, we're given protection. That's spiritual power. Just to illustrate this, Tamal Krishnamurti told me this one time. Prabhupada was riding in a train in India from one place to another place, and they got him his own little compartment in the first class coach, and Tamal Krishnamurti was posted at the door like shotgun, you know, protect, you know, keep people away from bothering Prabhupada. So he had to answer the call of nature. He went to the toilet, and when he came back, there was a man sitting in the compartment, and Tamal Krishnamurti was going to, you know, get the guy out of there. Prabhupada, you know, indicated no. And the man was saying, "Swamiji, can you give me your blessings?" And Prabhupada said, "Yes, I can give you my blessings." And he told Tamal Krishnamurti, "Get the other sannyasis and bring them here." So he brought the other sannyasis, several, and he said, "My blessing is I can make you like them." Completely attached to Krishna. And the man got really nervous and said, "Well, I gotta go now, Swamiji." That is spiritual power, where one can be habituated to activities of degradation, exposed to it afterwards, and not be attracted and protected by the shelter of Krishna. And so without a spiritual conception, without a personal conception, the Nirvishesha Shunyavadi, our founder Acharya, his prana mantra says, this is his mission, to protect us from that, because that doesn't provide shelter. It doesn't take one to the goal, and it doesn't provide shelter. We're very fortunate. You know, and then, so there's our own shelter taking, just the last part, our own shelter taking, and then assisting others who are looking around. Some people aren't even looking around. Some persons are just going about their worldly business. And somehow, as Prabhupada, by his own example, under the order of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, was extending the mercy and the message of Lord Chaitanya to the world. First it was the English speaking, and then it was India, and then, you know, the world. The audience that Srila Prabhupada was addressing was the world. And in this age of Kali, that's a difficult audience. So diverse, and so much cultural differences and modes of nature and chaos and quarrel, and bring the message of transcendence into that audience. So we're to assist him, we're to receive it. So it'd be very, very, I remember discussions with newer devotees about an impersonalist. Like, you know, what's an impersonalist? It's something like an extinct species, like what's a dinosaur or something. Maybe they have some impersonalists in India or something like that, but we never met an impersonalist. And, you know, we were quite naive. But Prabhupada's prana mantra is the Western world, which is filled with impersonalism and voidism, is not just, you know, some yogi teachers coming to teach impersonalism. It's impersonalism and voidism. again, the absence of a very clear personal conception. And as time passed, we started to understand a little bit more what that meant, a little bit more what that meant, and it's exactly pervasive. Different shapes and forms and degrees and colors and species and varieties, but very, very prominent. And then so there's obstacles to take shelter of the personality God, products of conditioning at least. But taking shelter, one who has taken shelter of the personality of Godhead in your own devotional practice, like, you know, as you chant japa each day, for example, that you're taking shelter in Krishna, not just mechanically performing something, and you feel better when you do that, so you keep doing it. But the more one can genuinely take shelter of the personality of Godhead through, you know, doing what you do for Krishna, and then sharing with others that example and the teachings that accompany the example and the happiness that accompanies it, it can help people, like, move from the impersonalism and voidism zone and start to look at personalism. And try to, like, figure it out. What does bhakti really mean? It's not just a behavior. It's a condition of heart. It, like the third chapter of Canto 2, devotional service, change of heart. The process of bhakti is meant to bring that about, changing of heart. So rather than no shelter, to the position of shelter. Rather than fruitive activities, to the position of doing everything for Krishna, and so on. The Bhaktivedanta purports are so nice. It's necessary for us to carefully read, carefully contemplate, carefully apply, and get a lot of mercy by sharing that with others, and as suits your nature to do so. That's our spiritual power. Any comments or questions? Yeah.
Thank you very much, Maharaj, for the class. Now, my question is based on tolerance, as to sometimes when we are out there distributing books or preaching, then we meet different types of people with different levels of consciousness, and some of them are impersonalists or, you know, followers of Buddha, so voidism is there, and they in turn start to talk, you know, things from their perspective. So how much should we tolerate, and at what point in time should we, you know,
put your foot down?
Yes.
It so much depends on the circumstance. It's very hard to say. It's very hard to say. I just like, you know, how I approach that kind of question is very, very rarely to, like, get really firm and let him have it. Rather, to teach by example, I find is more effective. When you're just, like, meeting somebody, like this example of book distribution, it's a one-time thing. It's more powerful if you exhibit the qualities of a Vaishnava, the gentle kind, then, like, you know, let him have it. That creates a lasting impression. That's my sense. But, you know, so when, it's, inspiration from the Super Soul will tell you when. But if you're going to go that direction, two things. You better be pure and not just like acting out of the other kind of anger. Because otherwise, you know, you're no better than them, frankly. It doesn't take them to a higher position. It gets them more entrenched and inimical towards you and who you represent. You know, those people that are just like, you know, hard and harsh. So it better be, you know, coming from a pure place. And then another consideration is when to get really firm. Somebody that they should know better. I'm thinking of two situations where I was real firm with somebody. It was like was it Bard College? It was kind of like a liberal arts school. And somebody, I was invited to speak, and so I spoke, and he came up afterwards and said something like, it's all one. And I'm God, and you're God. He was just babbling something that he had read that, you know, without any real realization. It wasn't like so invested in it either. And that was my reading. So, you know, I let him have it. It wasn't in a public forum. It was just standing with another practicing devotee and him. So I let him have it. But it wasn't done like in an angry way. It was reprimanding that, you know, kind of foolish talk. And I don't know what happened afterwards. You know, but there's definitely a full stop on, I'm not going to listen to you speaking this thing and not respond. Anyway, without the other example. Just sparingly. Prabhupada said, advising us, I can speak the way that I speak because I'm an old man. I can speak this way and people don't talk back. You can't do this. Besides the few other differences between us and him. So, what's wanted is to bring somebody up, not just, you know, check them. That thought has to be there, not just react. Prabhupada said, you're nonsense. And just say, you're nonsense and garbage and aparati and, you know. Anyway. How to elevate. Something else? Yes.
Thank you very much for your class. Imagine, so similar to this question. So, you know, when we have a community of devotees and there are some people now who are practicing, they come to the temple, they are, you know, interested, and, you know, they like the atmosphere. But, you know, they have their own, you know, family. Spiritual masters, like, you know, and if we analyze their studies, you know, they are all impersonalists. But, you know, they have that kind of attachment because, you know, their family has been following this person and, you know, they have also received initiation. So, although we know that, you know, it's wrong, based on the philosophy of the Vedas, how do we actually, you know, in a very,
you know the answer, but I'll give the answer. The best approach is make friendship with them. You don't confront the stuff. You just make friendship with them. And this stuff is going on, and you know, sometimes they speak about it, sometimes they don't speak about it. Usually they don't speak about it. And gradually, two things happen. Gradually, they become attached to the devotee. You know, you as a preacher, or somebody, or like, you know, the generic sangha is not as strong as a particular person that gets, you know. So then that means their heart opens. That's one thing. Then the second is gradually they start to see differences between what they, you know, what their Kula Guru taught them and Krishna consciousness. And we're not like hammering. They just can slowly see the difference. Like, you know, there's a cloudy day and there's a sunny day and there's a difference. And you know, they like the sunny day, although they have some affinity for the, you know, the guru. They like the sunny day. I'm sure you've been through situations like this with people. I've been, you know, hundreds and hundreds of times. One just happened just, you know, in Seattle. So then, you know, when you have a, either they ask or you have a sense there's enough openness, then you start asking questions rather than telling. And then, you know, if the sense is the door is open rather than, you know, don't go there, then, you know, little by little, based on the relationship and based on their seeing, there's differences. And, you know, so there's, at some point, there's a decision. Like, okay, now I have this attachment to Krishna consciousness and to certain devotees. Now, then they'll ask you, what do I do with this other attachment? That'll come from them. You know, at least, you know, or less, a willingness to take a look at it openly and share that look, taking a look at it with you. So it starts with trust, you know, and some, you know, it's trust, affection and affinity, and I don't feel so vulnerable. I'm not going to be judged by you or be manipulated by you. I'm just like, you know, I respect you. So what do I do with this? And that depends on the person. Just put it over there. Or, here's another answer. Every one of us was doing something before we're doing this. So how do every one of us face that question? So it's not like, you know, unique. We had something that we had some faith in something. Now what do we do with that? Faith in something, the persons who gave us that faith in something. Respect. This helped me at a certain stage in my spiritual path and spiritual trajectory, and so I'm not going to trash it. I'm just going to, it helped me. But now I'm moving on. So you don't have to like pine and be in anxiety about that. That was helpful for a certain point in my life, and now I'm in another point in my life, and I'm going to be at further points in my life. So thank you. And then, you know, keep going. My third grade teacher was, you know, really nice. But I'm not in third grade anymore. They taught me some things. And it was very nice. They were a very nice person. Very caring. Da-da-da-da. Part of my path. Depending upon the person. But the recent conversation I had with somebody like that was, okay, I feel good about that. There's a place. It's there's the place. Now keep going. Anything else? Anyone over this side? Okay, go ahead.
So I just like, since you are now part of the governing body council, I wanted to really know, like, in our society, do we have, you know, some thought of, you know, having Kshatriyas, you know, who protect and, you know, who basically administer, because there is so much of attack, you know, on the Sanatana Dharma from all kinds of, you know, corners in the world. And like, people just want to, you know, wipe it out. And in, from an economical point or, you know, religious point, so many things.
My thoughts are going to Yudhisthira Maharaj, where, like, when Bhima came back after the poison cake incident, he wanted to, like, let's get into it. Yudhisthira said, not now. We've been off in the forest, and we've just come back, and they've all the alliances and friends, and so, you know, we're not in a position to do something like that. Let's just wait. So, it's one of the fears that people have of religious organizations, that then, you know, now that they're strong, they're going to exercise it in a self-serving way or something. That's not the word, but you know, harsh way. So, in part, that was what the Bhagavad Gita on trial in Russia was about. You know, they're teaching violence, and it's a threat to the government, so we have to ban the book. Because they'll get people to go to arms and fight for their religion. So it's a dangerous book. So, I would say rather, you know, other skills of a Kshatriya to protect through the way the Prabhupada did it. Through teaching and by example. And by influencing those who are in that position. Like once Prabhupada was asked, Swamiji, your movement is growing so fast. One day, maybe you'll be elected president. And Prabhupada laughed. He said, no. I'm not interested in being president. We can advise those who are president. So more in that way, through spiritual training and education, those that have that position to use it, you know, not, but, you know, protect Sanatana Dharma is first, the people need to be educated. And then it's some of those persons who are educated might be government people. And then they can influence in their way. So it's not just police force, it's the other parts of the Kshatriya role, like the government. It may not be police officers, but, you know, influencing direction of policy and things like that. And we're far from that position right now. Some places, to some degree, it's going on. But certainly Prabhupada was very active in that area by, you know, his letter writing, and, you know, when he would travel, he would be eager to meet and then, you know, be very direct with people in government positions. But by advising them rather than being. At least that was the position he took. And my understanding is that's what he was advising us to do also. Last question.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you. So, just stemming from that same question, I was thinking along the same.
But you had your hand up even before he spoke.
Yes.
You've got two questions.
So the first question is, as you mentioned that we are always protected under the umbrella of the mission if we're falling seriously now.
We're protected by Krishna's potency. Yeah.
So if newcomers come to the temple and somehow get their emails registered in the database, later on we find that they're actually not, they're so-called from an outside organization, maybe Ritviks, maybe whoever, and they start sending emails to within the group that they have been posted,
okay.
Registered.
Gotcha.
Now, so as part of the temple management, as part of the team that we have, now, our duty is to tell the people that are there that this is all bogus and provides the information that is right, number one. Number two, how do we deal with such people who have tried, in it, you know, to do something like that? Should we deal with them in the manner, so to speak, in a private setting?
Yeah.
Or
first, yes.
And if they're not coming to temple anymore, just sending them?
Deal with them. And then if it doesn't go anywhere, then there's other things you can do. You can educate, and you can do mechanical, just block their mails.
But they have access to the personal emails.
And so then you advise the person to block their email address. And then there's ways, they can get another email address and send another.
So
if they want to do that, if they're obnoxious.
So
I already answered. You go, one step at a time. I would, go to the person. Please. And then, then another something, then another something. But I would, even before that, I would say, better figure out a way. I'm sure there's ways that when you add somebody's going into the future, you add somebody's name to the database and you send things out, it's not a list where they can see other people's email addresses, it just goes to them.
Like blind copy?
Yeah, blind copy. I do that. And even people that I know, when I send things out to a group, it's blind copy. Your other question. You forgot it.
Yeah, so if these people continue in their efforts to, somehow or other become hindrance to the progress of those new people who have joined by making friends with them and trying to take them away by coming to touch.
Then you have to educate your pup. Then you have to go, we really don't want to have to do this. But here we go. You can go to just like, steps. You're asking the same question again. So that somebody's continued, you do, 20 things and they're still doing. So you find out who are the persons who are being affected. You go to those persons. And if it goes to other persons, then you do a general announcement. You're free to do what you want to do. Here's our advice. This is that the ISKCON is we stand for these values, and this kind of behavior is an acceptable kind of behavior. Somebody wants to promote their idea. There's the universe to go promote their idea. We don't appreciate when someone comes to the temple and gathers names and starts cultivating people that take them away from what our values are and our teachings are. It's not nice. So, if you want some other teachings, you're free to go to some other teachings. But our advice is, don't participate in that kind of a program. Anyway, different ways of saying how, you consider and how you want to deliver such a message. If it persists after doing the 20 things and the person is still being obnoxious, you pull the plug. And the manifestation is not just people that come from some other, background, like the Kula Guru teaching and teacher and connect them to that person. There's a lot of detractors. So it's not a foreign thing here. It's all over. My experience is that after some time, those people find another audience and they go for another audience, and gradually it fades on its own. It goes along with the spirit of being a detractor. They're not just focused on one entity as the source of drawing from. they find something else. Yeah, there's some exceptions, but most just. Okay. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Yeah.